This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. Today is a historic day. I mean, this is, I'm speechless, Dave. I don't even know what to say, except I'm pretty tired because I was up till 4 o'clock this morning. But I feel like we're at the beginning of saving the healthcare system. And now that we actually have a champion to end Obamacare, I think that's going to be the beginning of the end of it. And hopefully all the things that have been rolling out will stop rolling out in the next couple of months or now, hopefully. What do you think?
I think it's going to, I don't know whether Trump and his advisors have a substitute plan or if they can work with Dr. Price, who has one, or I think it's going to take longer than we'd like, and I'm so simple-minded, I can't get a grasp on how the transition would possibly work. I think we're probably at least a good year out before anything's actually seen or starts affecting people, and I don't know what's going to happen in the interim. I have no clue. I don't know how they are going to plug the hole in the wall, you know, or in the dam, as it might be.
Well, the first thing you would go would probably be the mandate. So when you repeal it, the mandate stops, which means people are no longer going to be on the hook to have to purchase the insurance, which is a big deal, especially if you're young and healthy or you're older and you have no medical problems. And I think the next thing that would roll out would be that the insurance companies would start offering catastrophic plans again. So you no longer have a mandate. You have to cover all of these medical conditions. You have a population of patients who would buy your product if it was better. And now you're going to have to start making a better product. And so the first thing I thought of before all this went down was, you have to think about the market forces of what happens when you have a system that's controlled centrally by the government versus one that's free market. And you can actually understand how all of these pressures led to the disaster that was Obamacare. I mean, think about this for a second. If the government is the entity that controls the cost or access and the cost of the healthcare system by mandates, by deciding what needs to be put into a plan, then what the insurance companies are going to do in order to make money is they're going to do a couple of things. They're going to limit their doctor pool, because if you have less doctors to go to, then it takes longer for you to spend your health care money in your insurance. They're going to try to make less competition for themselves because they want to be the only game in town. So now you've seen dozens of insurance companies morph into five. That was for a market reason, really. Whoever has the biggest footprint has the most customers. If the government is making somebody buy your product, then you can make that product as bad as you want because they have nowhere to go. So I think that was the two market forces that led to the beginnings of it was always a poor product, but it got poorer. Then you add in the fact that you want patients to pay their premium but not use the product. So you raise the premiums so you can get more money up front. Then you cost shift to the patient, so you make them have to pay higher deductibles, higher out-of-pocket, which means they're going to self-ration. So then you have the perfect recipe for what Obamacare became. No choice in terms of your physician. You couldn't keep your physician. Doctors leaving, first of all, being cut out of the doctor pool, and then they left because you can stay open because you can't afford to keep your practice open and see an insured patient because you're not getting paid. And, it just became an unwieldy product where you had the government paying you to be as bad as you wanted to be and you got rewarded for it. That's where we've been, right? So I foresee now that force potentially is gone.
Hello?
Hey, Dr. Ermeling, how are you?
Hi, Elena. So sorry. Just one hassle after another.
No problem. I'm just doing the beginning of the show. This is we're just talking a little bit about the forces of Obamacare initially,
good.
Why it got so bad that it did, because it was the government centralized control and them pulling the purse strings and then the insurance companies following accordingly to make sure that they can make as much money
on
the backs
of the prologue
as possible. So today my guest is Dr. Richard Amerling, and I've had him on the show before. It's been quite a while, but I wanted to get your take on, one, the election, two, where the state of our healthcare system from your perspective, because you're actually on the academic side. You teach medical students, you are a nephrologist, and you run an academic department, so your stand is different from a strict, you know, independent doctor running a private practice. And you've been on the front of so many changes. I mean, your life has changed completely, moving from the country now into Grenada, which is a
right.
big deal. So first, let's get your take on the election. What do you think about that?
Well, it's pretty amazing. I'm thrilled that Trump finally got his act together and the last few weeks really waged a serious campaign, gave serious talks, made serious policy presentations. And he, I think, won over a lot of the hesitant, fence-sitting Republican base who had been alienated by him, like myself. And the other thing that, of course, contributed was the mounting woes of Hillary Clinton and the fact that she's still under investigation for various wrongdoings, and that that would continue even into her presidency unless they shut it down completely, which would mean a complete corruption of the Justice Department and the FBI. So I think that faced with that and seeing Trump really sounding reasonable and waging a solid campaign, it worked. It finally worked. I mean, I think he could have won by a landslide if he had done this from the beginning, frankly. And the other thing also that I think contributed was this issue of Obamacare. I think that the message got out that this was our last best chance to get rid of Obamacare, which has been a total disaster, as we all predicted it would be.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And if from your standpoint, my producer was asking me at the beginning, he couldn't actually foresee or figure out how he thinks it can be reversed. And my first thought was the mandate will be gone. Once you repeal it and get rid of it, the first thing that's going to loosen up the reins is the mandate being, you know, removed, because that's the thing that's been the yoke that's tried to force or has forced patients to buy a product that's too expensive, that doesn't work, and it's keeping this thing propped up. How do you see
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's true. It will collapse totally without the forcing aspect of it, the mandate, as you say. And the other thing is to enact positive reforms that give people a choice, such as being able to purchase insurance from any state, any willing provider, being able to maintain and contribute to a health savings account without restrictions, you know, maybe with a monetary cap, but without any real restrictions. Like right now, you have to have it coupled with a high deductible catastrophic plan. Well, what if you don't want one of those plans? You should be able to set up a health savings account without any plan, frankly, if you want to go without. So that sort of thing could immediately transform the healthcare landscape. And just getting the government out of these decisions and ending insurance mandates for coverage of everything that drive up costs, and let the insurance companies offer the plans that people want to buy, and, you know, start the process of decoupling medical insurance from place of employment, so people will own their own policies. These are such easy things to accomplish with a compliant Congress and a willing president, and I think Trump may just do it. I mean, he's promised he would. We'll now see, and we'll have to hold him to it.
Well, the most awesome thing is that the Congress is all Republican, which makes a
right.
huge difference. You don't have any more brakes on the system. I mean, this thing would have been gone had it not been for, well, I think there were Republicans, based for the most part, who didn't want to see it go because of lobby money. But now there's no excuse when the president can actually, you know, help the situation. And everything you just mentioned doesn't cost anything. This is not going to cost taxpayer money. It's just a change in the mindset, the system itself. I think that the healthcare system is one of the most, you know, perfect examples of entrepreneurship. Doctors are really about innovation and giving the patients what they want. And because there's been this chilling effect on the healthcare system for, what, 8 years now,
mm-hmm.
that there's been the direct primary care doctors that have come about. You have the old-fashioned concierge practices. You have surgeons no longer doing things in an OR but in the office. So there's been so much innovation that's removed the hospital as the middleman and let the doctor and the patient come to the forefront and make deals with each other. That's going to go crazy now, I would think, instead of all the doctors who've been sitting on the sidelines, afraid to make a move or closing their practices. Now there is hope, I think, for people to stop being a victim.
It's amazing, Elena. I mean, we were looking at a very strong possibility of, with Hillary Clinton, not only not getting rid of Obamacare, but her amplifying it and eventually transforming it into what they really wanted all along, which was Medicaid for all. And Hillary would have certainly added what she tried to do under Hillary Care, which was to make private practice illegal. So there wouldn't be an option. There wouldn't be an option to go outside the system. And can you imagine? I mean, this is how close we came to that kind of a bullet. Really, that would have nailed the profession completely. And patients would have been left with no options. Where do you go? I mean, the Canadians come to us. A lot of the world comes to us. Where do we go? Well, maybe come down to Grenada. You know, maybe that will be the answer.
It was we were right on the edge, like a hair's breadth away from losing our livelihood, our profession, our calling, and being able to help patients. And the system, we're going to talk about it. We're just going to take a break in about 30 seconds. But I want to talk about what it was like for you being in the system, you know, a month ago, 2 months ago, before any of this was on the launching pad to change. And how it's affected your ability to practice medicine. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Obamacare is failing. We all know that, but you need to know why and what you can do to get us back on the right track. Visit us at ObamacareWatch.org. This is Grace Marie Turner of the Galen Institute. Join us at ObamacareWatch.org.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
Understanding health insurance is becoming more challenging. If you currently have insurance, you probably notice that it costs more to see your doctor. And if you're able to keep your doctor, it takes longer to get an appointment. The bad news is this trend is projected to continue. Your costs will likely continue to rise, while your healthcare choice and access will continue to fall. The good news is Peachtree ENT Center has the answer to this problem. We believe in taking care of the whole patient because healing is more than writing a prescription. We are committed to working with you, and we specialize in providing affordable care for patients without insurance, those who are underinsured, and those with high deductibles or catastrophic coverage, and we offer same-day appointments. You no longer have to choose between staying healthy and paying bills, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Today, is like Independence Day for doctors. The fact that we've got our profession back and we can start moving forward again instead of cowering in fear and trying to stay afloat, we can actually go back to the mindset of thriving, of being advocates for our patients, of taking all the things that we had to learn to stay alive in this, you know, gulag of a healthcare system, and now putting it into practice. And Dr. Amerling, you were the head of nephrology, am I correct, at Beth Israel?
No, I was one of the senior staff nephrologists at Mount Sinai Beth Israel.
Gotcha.
Not the chief.
But you came from Beth Israel, and then it got annexed by Mount Sinai, correct?
That's right.
And yeah. That was the last time I spoke with you. So what happened in that transition for you?
Well, I knew it wasn't going to work out well when very shortly, I think within a month or so after the formal takeover, and of course they billed it as a merger, but it wasn't. It was a complete takeover with all of the clinical departments in a way almost being subsumed by Mount Sinai. The CEO of Mount Sinai, Ken Davis, who I don't know and I don't have anything against at all personally, I mean, I think he's probably a very nice guy, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal talking about how they were going to push forward with this whole concept of population health, which is a euphemism for medicine by the numbers and using population-based studies to define treatments for individual patients. Well, that's a formula for disaster, and I wrote as much in a letter in response, and it got published. So I think that probably sealed my fate at Mount Sinai. So it became clear that personally, they would almost certainly just let me continue to work there, but they were not going to increase my status in any way, and it was going to be tough going because they were intent on implementing this numbers-based approach. Now, one of the things that happened over the last couple of years that, of course, was extremely unpleasant was the forced transition into an electronic health record. This, I find, still to be almost intolerable way of taking care of patients, just because of the distraction that it represents in the office. The interference with the patient-physician relationship is just massive. And it does, of course, doesn't add to care. It just detracts from it because it's a distraction and it's time-consuming. So that was one factor. Then I started to see that they were going to be pushing through the meaningful use and eventually the PQRS and all the alphabet soup of what's coming down the road, performance measures that were going to be imposed. And this has always been my fear about what was going to happen with the centralized health care, which is the loss of physician autonomy and the decision-making at the central level, not only on how much you're going to get paid, but actually how to practice. And this is clearly going on, and it's happening according to plan, and the plan is being pushed by various crony capitalist agents, such as the pharma industry, the computer industries, who are all getting huge amounts of money from this. And I simply refuse to allow my practice to be dictated by these centralized standards. I think it's very bad medicine. And now is the time to start to push this argument. Now, you know that I've been pushing this for a long time, and we've discussed this. This is not just this government takeover. This is crony capitalism at its worst, with collusion between the government and other players, particularly the pharmaceutical industry, to advance the sale of their products through edict, by pushing them through practice guidelines, so-called evidence-based medicine, and payment for performance, which they now call value-based payment.
I still don't understand how they calculate value-based payment. For my sake, you know, the doctor is, unless you, from my take on it, You get value based by following every single alphabet guideline that they tell you to follow. And you have to have the patient not be admitted or stay in a short time and follow the DRG or the diagnostic-related payment system. That's how you actually get valued. Am I wrong? Is that how it works?
Yeah, well, that's right. Value-based, they say, is to hit performance targets such as for blood pressure numbers, hemoglobin A1C numbers, cholesterol numbers, none of which, by the way, have really been shown to extend life or even improve quality of life. And that's one way. The other way is by costing the system less. So the less you do, the better your scores will be, and the more money you get to keep. It's like the old managed care model, just with bells and whistles. You're going to make more for spending less on patient care.
Yeah, now, if the patient's healthy, is the worst. Yeah,
that's right. The patient's healthy, that's fine. But if they're sick, it's a death sentence.
And now I understand. I think listeners can understand why. I've been saying it for a long time, but we're talking about the doctors are now part of they're just a cog, and their whole job is to generate the money, but they still have to share in the largesse of the hospital, right? The money for these accountable care organizations and the government centralization and their pocketbook money, it goes directly to the hospital, am I correct?
Yeah.
Who's the first? Okay. And then they, after the year is over, then they dole out the leftovers for the doctors, et cetera. So how do doctors have any power in this system?
Well, they don't. And of course, they've given it up. Now, part of what's happened over the past, I would say, 10 years has been a massive movement of doctors out of private practice and into hospital-based systems. Now, I already was in one, but I witnessed it go on. And one of the things that told me that the end was near was when one of my cardiology colleagues, who I have known all my career at Beth Israel since 1990, and who had been a fiercely independent private practitioner, he sold out and moved into the hospital because he couldn't keep up with all the mandates, and particularly the electronic health record burden, which was huge. And he just felt he needed to seek shelter. And that was, to me, a sign that no one was going to be able to stay in private practice unless, of course, they completely divorced themselves from third-party payment and adopted a direct pay system or a concierge kind of system. That's the only way you're going to be able to make it in private practice. So that's still true, by the way, but I think that now there's a chance, there's some hope that we're going to be able to make it work with expanded health savings accounts, get patients to come and actually pay you directly for the services you provide, just like they pay a mechanic, a barber, or a plumber.
Well, we provide a service. It's not a right. You know, it's a service. You know, we are providing a medical service and therefore should be paid for what we do. I think the mindset, I'm hoping that the progressive socialist communist mindset of you own me and you own my labor will die out at this point, because that's what's been fueling a lot of this. It's like you need to do it for free and you should like it.
Right. And once the doctors give up their private practice, they move into the hospital system, they're going to get paid mostly on a salary, although there will be a compensation for productivity based on RVUs, the relative value units, which is the Stalinist system that was put in place by this guy, Hishaw, back in 1990 or 1991. I mean, that was his brainchild. He didn't actually put it in place. But it is going to reward doctors for doing more. And that was one of the points that I made in a debate in the Wall Street Journal against this guy who was arguing for the end of fee-for-service. I said, you know, they blame fee-for-service for the high cost of care, which is, of course, not true, because you have an incentive to do more. But then as soon as you get into the hospital-based system, you still have that incentive to do more. It's called the RVUs. The more RVUs you have, the more money you make.
Right.
So because they know that once they put doctors into a salaried situation with no incentive, their productivity just goes down the tubes.
Right.
You know, doctors are very hardworking when they have a real incentive, meaning they're going to get paid for their labor. They're going to get paid for the number of patients that they see and the time that they spent roughly proportionally. And once you start to just say, this is what you're making, you know, you can do all you want, but you're not going to make any more than this, they say, okay. Then I'm, you know, it's just like the old Soviet Union. The joke was, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work.
That's a really good analogy there. But, you know, but the whole thing starts off with the premise that doctors are lazy, that they don't care about what they do, they don't have a calling, and it's disrespectful from the get-go. You know, if you're spending an hour with a sick patient, who are you to tell me what that's only worth $80 for me to do that?
Right.
I mean, you are putting a value, an arbitrary value on us. And I just, how did we allow that? You know, how did we go from a proud, you know, from having a calling to somebody saying, well, you should take a fraction and you should like it. And then it just snowballed. I don't even know how that started. And it's within the last,
I know how it started. I know how it started. It really was pushed by Medicare with the mandatory assignment. In other words, in the early days of Medicare, it was a very attractive program. That's how they sold it to doctors. Mm. First of all, they said that they would never interfere with the way you practice medicine. What a lie that turned out to be. And they also paid you your usual, customary, and reasonable charge, no questions asked. So you could actually bill them for your full cost. And I think the patients had to pay 20%. That was always part of it. But there were no restrictions on balance billing. But then they gradually started to ratchet it down. And if you were a participating physician, then you agreed to take whatever they paid, and you wouldn't balance bill. Mm-hmm. And then you had to actually get paid by them directly. You could no longer just get paid by the patient and let the patient bill Medicare. And that was a huge step. This whole idea that you were going to be forced to take whatever the insurance paid, we should never have agreed to this. This was a huge mistake. And look at the dentist. The dentist never got involved in this. Lawyers never got involved in this. Veterinarians never got involved in this. And they retain control of their profession, which means you retain control of your rates. If you cannot adjust your hourly rate to meet your expenses and make a profit, you can't stay in business. It's that simple.
It's so economics 101.
Yeah.
On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Do you have problems with sinus pain and pressure? Do other people smell things that you don't? Have you lost the joy in eating because food just doesn't taste like it used to? Is your nose always stuffy no matter what you do? Maybe you have sinus or nasal polyps. These are generally benign growths that occur from chronic sinus infection or allergies that are either undertreated or have not been treated at all. At Peachtree ENT Center, we specialize in minimally invasive balloon dilation sinus surgery and correction of a deviated nasal septum and turbinate reduction surgery that can be done in the office. We use a state-of-the-art equipment so that you can see the problem. You will be a partner in your care, and together we will decide the course of treatment. We believe in old-fashioned medicine, where we take the time to fix the problem, not just medicate the symptoms. You can rest assured that all options will be offered before surgery is recommended, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
Whether cruising the strip in a 57 Chevy or taking the family on a vacation in a 71 Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser, you need to tune in to Classic Cars with Steve Ronaldo and Jim Weber every Saturday from 8 to 9 a.m. on AmericasWebRadio.com.
This is Skip Coriel, host of the Home Defense Show on America's Web Radio. Join me every week for a full hour of all the best and latest information on how you can get the skills and equipment you need to protect the ones that you love.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Amerling. He's the former president of the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, you know, one of the outstanding and great doctor organizations in our country. And actually, you know, I saw a commercial that AAPS had had put together prior to the election. I was, you know, screaming at my television. It was awesome. And now is the time for, I think, AAPS and doctors, independent-minded doctors, to take the forefront here and actually be the catalyst to wake up the rest of our brethren to, you have an option. You just described a system where once you become beholden, once you take a paycheck, you're on the hook for whatever the hospital wants you to do. And I noticed, too, that my malpractice insurance now had some sort of new policy where you have to carry a separate insurance than your strict indemnity policy. You have to have a second set. And it seems to me that that's because the ACOs, the doctors on the hook, it's almost like they've taken all the risk and shoved it on the doctor, even though the doctor is working for the hospital. Am I wrong in thinking that? But I've never seen anything like that in a policy.
I don't know about that, Elena. I'll have to look into it. But I do know that we are still on the hook for all of the outcomes that occur in this crazy system that is going to be increasingly dictated by the top down, including practice, including actual practice. So if you have a target cholesterol you have to meet and you have to put a certain number of people on statins just to meet that number, well, you're going to harm some of them, no question about it. These drugs are very toxic. In fact, this is one of my recent jihads. I've been anti-statins. I think the whole cholesterol hypothesis has to be reexamined. I think statins are more harmful than beneficial for most patients. And so if you don't go along with this and you harm, or if you go along with it, you harm some patients, you're liable. They're not going to sue the ACO. They're going to sue you. So
that's what
you have
I mean.
Maximum liability. You're going to have very modest pay. Because, of course, the way the hospitals work is they say, look, this is what you are costing us. And they sort of assign you a certain overhead. And they say, "But you only brought in X amount of dollars, so you're actually costing us money." But they completely ignore and discount all of the patients that you bring into the system. And that is the crucial aspect of what doctors do. Doctors attract patients. And if you don't have good doctors attracting patients into your system, you're not going to do well. And I think that what happens with Mount Sinai, in fact, why they're now closing Beth Israel, part of it is because so many doctors have left that the patient flow has fallen off.
Oh, wow. So you not only were annexed, but you lost doctors. You just went out of the system altogether. They just left Beth Israel, did not join Mount Sinai, and they're quitting. Is that what's going on?
A lot of doctors are leaving. They cut pay on a lot of the top senior staff, and a lot of them just said, no, sorry, I'm leaving. And they took their patients with them, and they went to NYU or Lenox Hill. And so the patient flow decreased, and they started to, I think, hemorrhage money from the hospital point of view. And they're now closing the hospital. A 700-bed hospital in downtown Manhattan is going to be closed. This is on the heels of the closure of St. Vincent's, which is an 800-bed hospital or something. I mean, so the people in lower Manhattan, they don't have many options in terms of hospital care. So it's quite astounding what's going on. But it's a flawed model, and the whole accountable care organization model is flawed because it relies on managed care techniques that have been shown to be ineffective. The population health approach is going to harm patients and won't improve anyone's health. So that has to backfire at some point. I mean, I think that they'll make money on it initially. They may, if the reimbursement is enough. But then if they do, the government will cut the reimbursement, and they'll be out in the cold. And that's the next thing to take on. Trump has to get rid of Obamacare. And then the next thing to take on is Medicare, because Medicare is a much more problematic system. It affects many more patients and much more money, and it's being completely destroyed by the latest so-called reforms that were passed in the MACRA legislation, with big changes in the way doctors are paid. It's all going to be this value-based pay, having to jump through many more hurdles to get less money with worse patient care. Worse outcomes will almost certainly come from this.
It's also, it was designed to actually, I think, kill the rest of the private practice doctors, to take them out of the equation and force them, what was left, into this system. They need some sort of bodies in the system to make it run. They need to control the whole thing. It's almost like having, the analogy of the holistic doctors versus the pharmaceutical-based healthcare system. They never want to have an option that can potentially be less toxic and cheaper and work, because if people saw that, they wouldn't do half of what they do in terms of the pharmaceutical-driven system. I think the same thing goes into play for doctors. Would you rather go to a doctor who's going to sit there for an hour with you, look at you in the face, not type in a computer, and figure out the best way to help you? And if that meant something Chinese herbal or something surgical or whatever was fitting, whatever fit for you, would you rather go to a doctor like that, or one who was an overseer for a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant who's following what you just described, population-based medicine, where, you know, you're a 35-year-old white male and you have to be treated this way and on these medications, you know, or you're a senior and you've already reached your peak, so we're not going to put you on dialysis or do the surgery because you're too old. I mean, that's the difference. Patients see that in stark relief. I would take 100 times, people would pick the first option and not the second. And that means the system collapses, don't you think?
Yes, for sure. The health of the population will be worsened by this approach, because none of the things that are being pushed by the evidence-based medicine group or the guideline group really make you healthy. They just treat certain numbers that are abnormal. The only key to good health is something that we've known for a very long time, which is to eat a healthy diet, get sleep, don't abuse yourself with various poisons, and stay physically active and keep your vitamin levels up. I mean, this is the very easy cures, and these work so much better than any medications work. But because the system is set up now with third-party payment of everything, patients don't have that much stake in the cost of their care. And if the doctor says you need all these five drugs for your cholesterol and your type 2 diabetes, which is, of course, treatable totally by diet and exercise, they're going to take the pills. Someone else they perceive is paying for them. These pills will not make them better. They're going to harm them in many instances. And the key to good health is going to go by the wayside. And unless we get back to real good medicine that is science-based as opposed to the so-called evidence-based stuff, then we're going to be participants in a very harmful system. And so that's what I think the next frontier has to be once we sort of get this political stuff settled. I think we can now really breathe a sigh of relief that we dodged this bullet. We're not going to have forever Obamacare. We are going to be free to have private practice the way we want it to want to have it. And we can get back to focusing on good patient care, which is not pushing pills. You know, the pharmaceutical industry, and I have friends in it, and I don't think that they're all bad people, and they do come up with good products, and, you know, there's a lot of good there. But the way they have pushed and marketed drugs, to the extent that they pretty much control the publication of data, they control the studies that are done. They control the publication of the studies, how they're reported. And then these studies form the basis of the evidence-based recommendations that the guideline committees come up with. The guideline panelists are almost all getting paid by the pharmaceutical industry in one way or another. So they come up with recommendations for more and more intense levels of treatment, and you end up pushing more and more pills on healthy patients. I mean, it's just, it's totally bad.
I absolutely agree. And it's, there's so much conflict of interest in the system. There's so much money in the system.
Yeah.
And they get to decide everything. Now, my fear, and I think another thing we need to guard against, is the loss of informed consent. Because I think vaccinations have become a big business. There's no vetting going on in some of these vaccines that have come out. They're just fast-tracked. You don't even know if they're healthy or safe. For example, the new flu vaccine, which has some of the same adjuvants in it as the Gulf War. I think it was the disease they were vaccinating for. But it had something called squalene in it, which hasn't been in any of the vaccinations since the Gulf War. And it's back in this flu shot coming up this for the season. And, of course, it's mandated, or I should say, recommended for people over 60. And there's another version of it recommended for people over 40. No flu miss this year, just the injectable. I mean, come on. If they make a system like they want to, you will be forced to give your patient these vaccinations because it's part of good medicine and what they deem as a, you know, evidence-based system. And I have a real problem with that. And I hope that goes by the wayside because that is not healthcare. You cannot do something without informed consent. That's, you know,
that's right. And that's one of the reasons why we must retain and build and expand a core of independent physicians, you know, what Twyla Brace calls the wedge of freedom. We have to keep expanding that and getting more and more physicians who will take the chance to go out on their own. And I think now we have that ability. Before, and by the way, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to come down here, so I could be able to talk to the students and tell them there is another way to practice. You don't have to become a slave in a hospital and just do what you're told. You can actually think for yourselves and practice the way you think you should practice. And now I can tell them this, and they are actually going to be able to go out there and build a private practice again. And you know, if Hillary Clinton had won, they wouldn't. They would have to become slaves of the system.
Well, I had a thought when you told me that you left the United States to move to it's St. George's Medical School, right?
Yes.
In Grenada. I thought, you know, you're going to be training the doctors that I would want to go to. And it was ironic because you're going to have people who are better doctors who've been trained outside the country than the doctors who were trained in the American medical school system. It's completely different.
But that's what I'm hoping. Go ahead.
No, I apologize. I'm going to cut you off. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. You know, for example, the physiologic approach to management of type 2 diabetes is so obvious, yet most people learn that it's all about glycemic control. Even the diabetologists are starting to roll that one back because they see that it just doesn't work. So if you're just focused on glycemic control, then you're going to be pushing all sorts of medications, including insulin, that will make your patients gain weight. And then they will never get better. The only hope for a type 2 diabetic to get off medication is to lose weight. If the medications make them gain weight, they're going to lose. They're not going to succeed. And if you can get them off medications and have them lose weight, the diabetes, in fact, goes away. And the complications go away or stabilize. So that's the physiologic approach to managing type 2 diabetes. And that's what I'm hoping to get people to, you know, sort of go back to real science based on physiology, based on pathophysiology, based on pathology, anatomy, knowledge of pharmacology. You know, the bisphosphonates for osteopenia and osteoporosis are bone poisons.
Right.
They cause these long bone fractures that are occurring with greater frequency in women who have been on these for years. And if you know the physiology of bone, you know this. You know that these paralyze bone remodeling, which is necessary to maintain healthy bone. So just based on that, you should never prescribe them. But they're being pushed by all these official agencies.
I totally agree. And we're going to skip this break because I think this is important to hammer home. Part of what we've been, all this evidence-based medicine driven by the pharmaceutical industry for self, self-fulfilling prophecy of more profits is not helping people. They're actually, I always said this, if people are on more medications but they're sicker, something's not working. You know, they have a completely opposite mindset. Their job is to put you on a medicine or two or three or four that you have to take every day. That's how they operate. That's counterproductive and intuitive to what the doctor should be doing, which is to get them off the medicine, get them out of the office. I don't want to see you in my office for the same thing over and over again. I want to fix the problem, have you come in for something else. And maybe now we can actually move the mindset, and that's what you're doing. I mean, you're now professor of clinical medicine there, right? So you're teaching your medical students how to think. That is gone all of a sudden. There's no common sense anymore. No one works up a problem. No one seems to have a methodical way of asking a question and coming to an answer. They just skip to, well, I think it's this, and let's get a CT. You know, that's not how I learned how to treat your patients, you know? It was the confirmation of what you already came up with, not just, let's just throw it up on a wall and see what we got. That's expensive. This is right. How you actually save money, is if you use your brain, which is the major player in healthcare, and figure out what the problem is, and then make a plan of how to fix it, and fix it, not just manage it. That's the key.
Right. This whole concept that has come about of all these chronic diseases is actually bizarre. And it's a new thing. Why should somebody be on diabetes medication their entire life? Why should someone be on lipid-lowering therapy their entire life? Why should somebody be on antihypertensive therapy their entire life? If you get a good lifestyle, diet, exercise, et cetera, you don't need these drugs. You don't have a chronic disease. You have a temporary problem. And the goal of every doctor should be to get patients off medications and actually restore good health.
Isn't that amazing? And also, there's normal variation, right? So what's normal cholesterol for you is not for me. Or people run at higher blood pressures, and it's not abnormal for them. But if you lower them, they start passing out, they've got headaches.
Sure.
But everybody, they're fine. They're running marathons. You have to now look at looking at the individual and not the population. That's where you get into trouble. Because we're not all the same. You know, even within family members, no one's the same. So to say that you have a norm for every sex, every race, every age is ridiculous. We need to really stand up and start talking about that now as doctors. I think we've been so put under duress and being made to be scapegoated and to be fearful of peer review and all these things to shut us up. It's like the political correctness for the medical profession.
That's what
you
it is.
Think of
You're
your
so right.
I think I'm coining some new term now, but that's what it is. You know, you shut up, put your head down, don't make waves, don't be an advocate for your patient because they're coming for you, and you will no longer practice medicine.
That's been what
we've been dealing with for, 15, 20 years, and it's so subtle how it rolled out. But it all comes down to the pocketbook, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And I've been fighting this whole guideline practice movement practice guideline movement for years, and my colleagues used to almost ridicule me for taking this on. They didn't understand that they were going to use these to control them, and all physicians are going to have to then prescribe based on these guidelines, which are arbitrary, full of conflicts of interest and industry financing, industry backed. And just declaring the conflict of interest doesn't remove it. This is what people don't understand. So, but it is going to be enforced by payment for performance or by sham peer review or other means, and you're going to be coerced into practicing bad medicine. And that's what I saw coming, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to get out and see if I could do something to influence it from the front end, as opposed to from the back end.
Now, from a teaching standpoint, because you taught here in the States as well, and you were still interacting with medical students in Mount Sinai as well as Beth Israel, correct?
Yeah, but on a very limited basis. I mean, the medical students who would rotate through our division, but that's a small number. So it's not like talking to a lecture hall with 1,000 students, which is what I'll be doing here.
So from the limited experience that you did have, because I was under the impression that the students were completely different. You know, they were not, the mindset is basically go along, get along. You know, if you have a patient with multiple medical problems and they're a senior, then it was, you know, the mindset was they've lived a good life and they're taking up resources and they're costing us too much money. Therefore, they should be put in palliative care and hospice. That was kind of almost an antagonistic view of these patients. And said, they're a problem. We don't want to treat this. And that's the take that I've gotten from the mindset of the American medical student at this point. Did you ever come across anything?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. This idea that people are starting to consume precious resources, they're a drain on the system, and that physicians have a responsibility not just to their patients but to society in general is now an official part of the AMA's code of ethics, and the ACP has long been into this. I mean, they are, I call the ACP the American Communist Party. They're so far left. But this is the way things have been going. The utilitarian approach, once you've outlived your usefulness, well, you know, no good spending lots of extra money on you. Now, that doesn't mean we should be doing extraordinary care on everybody who's 95 and demented, but we should make these calls. This is what I've always believed. Physicians working with a patient and their family should be the ones making the call on when enough is enough and when to pull the plug or when to not push for further treatment. We should be making these calls, not bureaucrats. But where it's headed is that it is going to be, these calls are going to be made by bureaucrats in the form of ethics committees, et cetera. And that's a dereliction of the physician's duty. I think if the doctor really has a good relationship with the patient and their family, which is, of course, increasingly difficult in the day of the hospitalist, the doctor should make this call, and it should be done in a way that the family's happy and the family's at ease. If you ask a family member, well, what should we do here? Should we, you know, do everything? Of course they're going to say yes. You know, this is just not good medicine. You have to make the decision, but do it in a way that brings the family in and makes them, gets them involved. But you have to make the call. Don't lay it on them.
It's the relationship. It's all about the relationship between the doctor and the patient and their family. And a lot of things go on now in the hospital where they don't talk to the family at all. They just do things. So you've gotten vaccines before. As soon as you roll in, you're getting an antibiotic and a vaccine for God, for pneumonia. I don't even know how that works, how you're a critically ill patient. Your immune system's already going nuts because it's under duress, and they shoot you up with a vaccine for pneumonia? Or like, what is that? How do you even get away with something like that? And how many outcomes have been affected by all of the things that you get as a mandate? I remember last time you spoke with me, we talked about the diabetic patient and all the things that were in the laundry list of things that would have to happen, you know, not only the sliding scale of insulin, but other things that were part of a protocol. Who set that protocol up? And how expensive is the protocol? And is it really necessary?
Right. No. So much money is being wasted on not only unnecessary but harmful care. And in one respect, the critics have a point, which is that we do spend more money per patient than probably any other country in the world, and our outcomes certainly are not much better, though they are in certain areas, that's for sure, like cancer care, et cetera. But we're not really getting our money's worth because we're doing so much that is unnecessary. It's being driven by industry, for example. Why do we have to be spending $20 billion a year on diabetes and statin medications when a healthy lifestyle cures all this stuff, and the Mediterranean diet gives you better heart protection than all the drugs in the world? So I just don't get it. We are wasting a huge amount of money. Listen, we would be paid less, probably, as doctors, in an overall sense, in that we'll be having healthier patients. The patients who are paying out of their health savings accounts are not going to want to be seeing you every week or every month unless mm-hmm. they're really sick.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so we'll do less, and happily so, as long as the patients are healthier. But
I agree.
And if we need to increase our hourly rate, so be it, you know, to, mm-hmm. to make ends meet. But in terms of volume, we will do much less.
Well, volume doesn't equal good health care. I submit you can't see 60 people in a day and give them adequate brain power and actually care for them. All you're doing is managing meds, and that's what we're
right.
trying to break. That's where the
that's
money's
right.
going. And
yeah.
then you have the inflated cost of the hospital jacking up a $2 pill to 20 or 30, and nobody's standing on them. So, you know, I like to see also transparency. One of the Trump planks was that doctors, hospitals would have to put their prices online and make it transparent so people can actually be a consumer in their health care. Imagine that. That would also mm-hmm. do wonders to bring the cost of health care down, because you couldn't make it up as you went along in a hospital setting.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole Chargemaster scandals with the insurance companies setting the prices for these things. You know, you call up a hospital to find out what a given procedure costs, and no one can tell you. They don't even know.
I know.
It's really funny. It's tragic, but funny.
Look, in the last second that we have, is there a way that people can reach you? Are you still writing regularly in blogs or anything
like
that?
I had to stop my writing during this whole transition, but I'm going to get back into it. And my focus is going to be on all of these health scams that are being pushed on the unsuspecting public, such as the diabetes scam. You know, why should you have to take all these pills and shoot yourself up with insulin and even measure your blood sugar four times a day? All this stuff is way excessive. You go on a healthy diet and you cure your diabetes. The statin scam is really bothering me. Why we're pushing these toxic medications on patients who are healthy. So I'm going to start to write regularly again about this and sort of get people hopefully thinking about getting healthy again, as opposed to maintaining a state of chronic disease for the benefit of the pharmaceutical industry and the medical establishment in general.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking time out to come on the show today. I look forward to those blogs so I can have you back.
All right, Elena, and I'll have you come down here just as soon as I can. I'd love to have you give a talk to the students.
It'll be my honor.
All
and
right,
thank
Elena.
You so much, everybody. Thanks, Richard. Thanks for listening to Medicine on Call.
Take care.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.